Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We are presented by The Athletic. I am coming to folks, not live, because you guys are listening to a recording of me speaking right now, not necessarily watching me on YouTube or something like that, but I'm coming to you from Sydney, Australia right now because I've moved, as I announced on, what was that? I guess it was Tuesday, maybe Monday, American. The days are all fucked up, as I'll talk about with Spencer here momentarily, but Spencer Perlman's on the podcast and he's going to be the first guest that I've had since moving to Australia because I want to talk about the NBA draft and I want to talk about the NBA finals. And there are very few people that I feel are better equipped to talk about both of those things than Spencer. So Spencer, how you doing, man?
I'm good. Thank you for that intro. Thanks for having me again. Yeah, I can't believe you actually still want to talk about the same draft class we've been watching for the last, you know, year, whatever it's been.
So want to, I guess, is versus have to, I guess, is like the breakdown there. I get paid to talk about this draft class for another, I guess, 6 weeks. And then I'm excited to move on to talk about Cade Cunningham, because holy shit, if you guys haven't seen Cade Cunningham yet, he is a monster. I'm excited to talk a lot about like Usman Garuba and his weird ass game and how that's going to fit in the NBA. Like I could not be more excited to move on to the 21 draft class, but man, we still got about 6 weeks to go, man.
Yep.
So the way this is going to break down, we're going to talk about the NBA Finals for like 20 minutes here at the start. The Lakers are obviously up 3-1 and continue to have LeBron James and Anthony Davis. So while those games have been interesting and fun for a number of reasons, I don't know that we're going to spend like a crazy amount of time on it. The next thing that we'll talk about, though, is going to be the NBA draft, and we're going to break down the top five wings in the 2020 NBA draft, particularly Isaac Okoro, Devin Vassell, Patrick Williams, Sadiq Bey, and Aaron Naismith, and kind of discuss where both Spencer and I have those guys ranked right now. I just released a big board on Friday in the U.S. before I came over to Australia and kind of broke down why I'm moving wings up my draft board just based off of what we've seen in the playoffs. I mean, I would imagine that you kind of feel the same way, right, Spencer, just in terms of wings playing an incredible importance in the way that these playoffs have played out.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it just shows like, you know, the importance of you can't have enough versatile guys in the wing who can defend, you know, multiple positions and potentially space the court, pass a little bit.
Yeah, it's just an incredibly valuable skill set now. Being able to play multiple different types of lineups, being able to, you know, potentially go small, hopefully while maintaining some size on the court. It really is just the most important thing that you can find are these versatile two-way wings that can defend multiple positions and knock down shots other than finding stars. And I think that maybe that's something else we should talk about because there is like a bit of a breakdown for me on my personal board, even for what we're talking about here in regard to the importance of wings versus who I have at the top of my draft board, because I have LaMelo Ball and I have James Wiseman up there. Like I have these guys that are one and two on my board that don't really fit the way that the NBA is going. So maybe that'll be an interesting discussion point as well. But let's start with the Lakers taking a 3-1 lead over Miami. I haven't talked about the finals yet on the podcast because I've been moving, but I guess that what this comes down to for me is that the Lakers have LeBron James and Anthony Davis, and both of those guys are, I guess the best way to put it is two of the most versatile superstars in the league that can do such a wide variety of different things, and they're better than anyone on the Miami Heat. Like Jimmy Butler is great. He had an absolutely outstanding game three where he dropped a 40-point triple-double. But Anthony Davis and LeBron James are probably going to go down. LeBron is one of the two best players of all time. Anthony Davis is probably going to be a top 30 to 35 player of all time by the time it's done. And it's just really hard for Miami, who got through the Eastern Conference Finals on the back of their own versatility and their own ability to present problems for opposing teams, to match up with two versatile stars that are just better than anything they have.
I mean, I think it's just also kind of showing that, like, you know, you can get so far just, you know, simply out hustling the players and being more physical and playing smarter. But, you know, at the end of the day, talent wins. And, you know, it's, I guess it goes back to part of the issue with, like, D'Antoni's old teams, that you can have a phenomenal defense and a phenomenal offense, but if you play great defense, the offense is going to win. Although, you know, it obviously didn't work out in his benefit. Miami can play great defense for, you know, 18 seconds, 17 seconds, but the talent is just going to, you know, inevitably win out. And they're just so difficult to guard because you can't really put a small on LeBron because he'll overpower him. And obviously you can't put a big on him. And the same thing with Anthony Davis, as he's been spreading the court a little bit more, he's providing more room to attack, even if, you know, it hasn't really necessarily been as fruitful as it could have been or should be. The Lakers, and particularly LeBron and Anthony Davis, are just too talented for anything Miami has.
So it's kind of funny because I feel like the Lakers aren't even taking full advantage of some of the things that Miami is presenting to them. They continue, for instance, in the first half of game four, they continue to go to these heavy post-up looks, and I don't really understand why they keep doing that. Their best route to offense throughout this entire series has been taking advantage of the mismatches that Miami, being forced to play Duncan Robinson and Tyler Hero and now Kendrick Nunn, has wrought. You can get those guys into pick and roll and either force a switch or force them into being matched up with someone like a LeBron James or an Anthony Davis, either, you know, by using the guy that they're guarding as a screener or by using just Anthony Davis in actions that get those kind of mismatches. And they don't really take advantage of that as much as someone like, if Eric Spoelstra saw those, you know, worst defenders out there on the court, he would be using all of his matchup might and his matchup hunting might to go out and try to find who they can actually take advantage of. He'd be, for instance, like Tyler Hero has been guarding Alex Caruso and Rajon Rondo quite a bit. Like, he'd just be using Alex Caruso and Rajon Rondo as screeners for LeBron James, enforcing all sorts of different matchup issues. And Miami's worst defenders, they're not like awful defenders in a lot of cases, but they're not great defenders. Their worst defenders are actually struggling with those exchanges whenever the Lakers choose to put them in those positions. So I actually think that, like, this is probably going to be done in five if they end up starting to take more and more advantage of what Miami has to present to them at the end of the day. Like, I think that the Lakers are up 3-1, even missing some opportunities on offense, which at the end of the day kind of speaks to what you were saying, Spencer, with the Lakers just being such a mismatch magnet due to LeBron James and Anthony Davis's presence.
Yeah, I mean, those two guys get, they, you know, deserve all the attention that they get on defense. And the shooting, I think it was Seth Partnow, he's been putting out the stats game by game over the playoffs and just kind of how random it's been. I remember it was particularly jarring with the Denver series and like how they went 3-for-18, I think, or 3-for-12 on open three-pointers in one game. The Lakers haven't really been hitting threes at a particularly high clip. Like KCP, I think, is at 26% from three, and he's gotten some good looks. You got to figure that at a certain point, they're just going to start falling because, I mean, again, they're not bad looks. So once that happens, hopefully, you know, LA continues to take advantage of the mismatches. And I guess if you're a Laker fan, you know, you're going to want the series to end the next game. And I think there's a pretty good chance that could happen.
Yeah, I would agree. And the other big thing that happened here in this game four particularly is that the Lakers figured out kind of how to handle Jimmy Butler. Like, they just started going under on Butler screens and daring him to shoot, as opposed to waiting for him, switching on to him with smaller players and getting mismatches. And Jimmy's been trying to hunt those mismatches throughout the series. Going under and just basically daring Jimmy to shoot is the way that the Lakers probably should have been defending from the jump. And yeah, they've just kind of figured this out now in a real way. And like, even though Duncan Robinson has been really good on dribble handoffs and has been really good as a scorer over the last couple of games, and even though they have some real offensive firepower, at the end of the day, they really need Jimmy to take over. Otherwise, I don't think that they have enough offense in order to counteract the defensive questions that come up from playing guys like Kendrick Nunn and Duncan Robinson and Tyler Hero and Kelly Olynyk as many minutes as they do. I mean, there were times out there where they had Kelly Olynyk, Kendrick Nunn, and Tyler Hero together, and it's just like, how are the Lakers not finding open shots every time? And for the most part, they did, and sometimes those shots didn't fall, but this is just kind of a series where it's a pretty distinctly bad matchup for Miami, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I wanted the Celtics to make it to the finals, A, because I just think seeing LA-Boston would have been a cool storyline, but also I think their offensive talent actually matches up maybe over, like, across the board, you know, from one to from one to eight better. But again, as you were saying, it's showing that Miami needs more help scoring. And you know, they can play a couple of shooters, but I still think they need that other guy who can be, who can give, you know, similar to what Dragic was doing, just better, be that secondary, preferably primary scorer, and move Butler as a secondary scorer a little bit more. But you know, you can only run so many dribble handoffs with Bam and so many pick and rolls with Jimmy Butler before either they get tired or their defense starts to figure it out. But yeah, I mean, they've pretty much maximized what they could be doing aside from just missing some shots. They just need that final piece.
Yeah, and you know, you brought up losing Goran Dragic, and I think that's 100% an enormous key in this series as well, as Goran Dragic was that guy for them. Like, look, they obviously would prefer to have someone a little bit better than Goran, but Goran's averaging over 20 points per game in the playoffs, or at least was before he got hurt in this series. And the drop off from him to Kendrick Nunn has been just so substantial on both ends. Like, Kendrick Nunn just kind of isn't ready for the high level decision making and rapid reaction time on both ends of the court that has to happen in the NBA playoffs for teams to have success. Like, when he's out there, they're just kind of hemorrhaging points on both ends in a way that just does not happen. Like, they're actually drastically missing Dragic defensively, even in a way that, you know, you would find stunning coming into the playoffs, right? Let alone his offensive ability, which is really, really important because of his ability to knock down mid-range pull-up jumpers and his ability to get all the way to the rim and knock down those little floater shots, and his ability to keep teams in rotation by making that quick, rapid reaction kick-out pass.
Yeah, it's definitely a huge loss. Completely agreed with that.
So I guess the final thing that I'll just ask here is, do you really see there being any way that Miami can get back into this?
Get back into it as in force six?
Force seven games? Let's say, can they win two in a row?
No. I actually had Miami losing in six. I thought they'd win game one, and I also thought Frank Vogel was going to get a technical foul in that first game, but that was wrong. I don't really see any way that's going to happen, because Bam, I still don't think is 100%. And you know, if he's the only guy who can really defend Anthony Davis aside from Anthony Davis when he's not aggressive, or he's just kind of, you know, or he's in foul trouble, I just don't really see another way, unless if Goran comes back and he's like 100%, which he was 100% of the player that he was before, but I don't think that's medically possible.
Yeah, I think it would take Goran Dragic being 100%, Tyler Hero returning to what he was against the Celtics, which I think was probably just a touch over where he is right now as a player, in terms of what you can expect consistently game in, game out from him. And they would need Bam to be back 100% healthy as well. It's a bit unfortunate. Like, if I was a Miami fan, I would feel just really bummed about the way that these playoffs have turned out, in the finals particularly, just because of the injuries. But, man, the idea that some people had coming in that, you know, Miami is actually a perfect team for the Lakers because they can minimize some of the matchup issues that LeBron James and Anthony Davis pose, I just don't really see that, to be honest. Like, I don't think that there's really a way for LeBron James and Anthony Davis to be minimized to the extent that would be necessary, especially when someone like Kentavious Caldwell-Pope is playing as well as he is, and when Rajon Rondo has turned back the clock in these playoffs to be as effective as he has been as well.
Yeah, I mean, finding anybody who can actually match up with those two guys and bring them down to any noticeable amount is difficult enough.
It's pretty clear to you that LeBron James should be the MVP here, right?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I guess overall, yeah, just because, like, he and Anthony Davis, they both kind of had their inconsistencies, whether it's a half or foul trouble or just kind of being soft. And I think when it all kind of comes down to the end, I'd probably just give the edge to LeBron just because he still is the engine for that team. But I mean, if Davis hadn't had, was a game three or game two of the foul trouble, I could have seen him winning it all, I guess.
Yeah, it was game three with the foul trouble. And
okay,
I guess that what I would say is LeBron has had some turnover issues the last couple of games. He probably did open the door a little bit, but I mean, you watch these games, LeBron is very clearly leading the way in such a substantial way on offense, and his presence on defense for Miami is very real, even if they kind of are going away from him as much as humanly possible. I think it kind of says a lot that they're trying to go away from him and potentially take the ball out of some of their better players' hands. Anthony Davis has been just all over the place defensively. And if you want to try and make a case for Davis, I think it lies on that end of the court. His help defense, his rim protection, everything that they're doing in order to slow down this Miami offense, particularly on the interior and in the paint, that comes down to Anthony Davis's incredible defensive ability. But man, LeBron is averaging something like 28 points, 11 and a half rebounds, and 9 assists a game. And it feels like he has been slightly off. Even like yesterday, I was like texting some people, I was like, does LeBron look sick in the first half? Because like, he just didn't look fully engaged, and then the third and fourth quarter he just turned it on and it was lights out. So I would understand it if you want to try and make an Anthony Davis case based off of defense purely, but it's LeBron for me all the way. Like, it kind of just has to be, kind of like you said, right, Spencer, with him driving the play just so substantially for them.
Yeah, I mean, the engines, they drive teams. Like, that's why there's such an, you know, there's such an onus on them and getting those guys and finding those guys in the draft or free agency or trading for them, just because they can not only raise the floor, but they can raise the ceiling also. So if it comes down to two guys, then, yeah.
Maybe let's stop there on this little breakdown and go to commercial break, and then we'll come back and talk about what finding a creator means in the NBA draft and why that's so important in the NBA draft. So stick tight. We'll be back in a second here. Okay, and we're back. And this is a great transition. I'm sure that you meant to do this as someone who is an expert in podcast segues, Spencer. You really...
Believe it or not, that was actually intentional.
Oh, that's amazing. I love it. It's absolutely fantastic because it allows us to move forward into the draft section of this podcast. And I want to start with my updated big board because I still have LaMelo Ball at one. I moved James Wiseman up to two. I've just been talking to enough people that have seen him in Miami who says that he just looks like an absolute monster right now. And having seen him over the course of the McDonald's Hoop Summit, etc., camps going into his collegiate year, and then seeing those few games in college, it just continues to add up to me that this guy has a ridiculous ceiling in such a real way in the NBA draft and in his NBA future that it's hard for me to pass that up, in that he can just be such a remarkable difference maker on the defensive end of the floor. But I wrote a big thing on Friday talking about how shooting and how defensive versatility are the two most important things that you can find in the NBA right now, outside of finding that number one shot creator. And I got some pushback from people saying, like, how can you have LaMelo Ball at number one if you think that those two factors are so important, because the two things he doesn't really bring to the table are defensive intensity and shooting ability. And I think there's something to that, but at the end of the day, finding that shot creator who can be the leader of an offense just so drastically outrates it, outvalues anything else on the court, that it's hard for me to look past LaMelo Ball if I think he's the best potential creator in this class. Where do you kind of fall on the dissonance of valuing shooting and defense while also valuing creation and how it relates to LaMelo Ball?
I think specifically with LaMelo, obviously we have the elite passing and, you know, the vision and everything, just him getting everybody involved. But I also think the idea that he's, you know, some defender or non-defender who has never played defense and is not going to improve and he's not a shooter at all, I think that's kind of wrong. I think it's important to look at the context with where he's been. You know, 2 years ago, he was playing in the Lithuanian league, or he was doing the thing with his father's brand and traveling, and no defense there, Inspire, no defense. Like, this past year was pretty much the first time he was ever asked to defend.
Zero accountability early in his career defensively.
Yeah. And so when you come at it from that angle and you see, you know, it was definitely inconsistent, but you see some of the nice rotations that he would make, keeping the shell or rotating down to the paint, you start to buy it a little bit more. Not that he's going to be some high-level defender, but that he really just has to be, you know, average or probably slightly below average for him to be a net positive overall. And then with the shooting, you only need to be enough of a shooter to get the defense to respect you. And he shot, I think it was 42 above the break threes, off the pick and roll, which is where you make, you know, that's where you create the space. And they're deep threes also, and he shot 34% or something like that. If he's taking five threes a game and if he's hitting them at 34-35%, that's, at least I think that should be enough to drag the defense out, which then opens up everything else. So take away the isolations, you know, those just terrible shots, then his percentages go up. So I guess I'm coming at it from the angle that he's not the bad defender. He's not as bad a defender, rather, as some think he is. And he's also a better shooter specifically in relation to where he will be getting most of his opportunities, which will be in the pick and roll.
So let's take both of those things as disparate parts, right? Defensively, I think, is an interesting place to start, because I think he is a really bad defender right now. And would you agree with me that he was a bad defender this year? Not that he doesn't show defensive upside, but that he was a bad defender this year.
Yeah, I'll say he was a bad defender. More so, I think, in isolation than in team defense, except he'd also have random possessions where he's defending guys 35 feet away off ball, which is odd. But yeah, better than expected, but still bad overall, sure.
Yeah, and I think that that's kind of where the difference comes in a lot of ways for people, right? Is like the tape of LaMelo Ball defensively this year is pretty bad. And in that he made some very problematic defensive decisions. I think that he often took the easy way out defensively or wasn't hyper engaged. I think I counted 7 or 8 possessions this year, having watched all of his minutes this year, because there were what, like 450 of them. I think I counted 7 or 8 possessions he should have been tagging down onto a roller out of pick and roll. And he was just like wiping his shoes, right? Like that kind of stuff is stuff that has to change. But when he was engaged, I actually do agree with you that there was some very clear, real reason to believe in him defensively, is maybe the way to put it. He's going to really have to improve his engagement, improve his desire, just improve his level of just like giving a fuck on some level, right? Like that's a skill on defense, just truly being engaged all the time. That's where he needs to improve. When he was locked in, though, like you said, he made the right defensive rotations. He stayed within the team's shell. There were often possessions where he would rotate down and try to be like a weak side rim protector. And yeah, he doesn't really have the like strength yet to be able to hold his ground there and to be able to really make an impact, unless he's just like straight up swatting at the ball and trying to block a shot. But there's enough there for me to think that he can be a reasonable defender at some point if he chooses to lock in, even though the tape was bad. Because if you remember at UCLA, like Lonzo was also a pretty poor defender overall. Like there were possessions where he just kind of disengaged and then that became a problem. But once he got to the NBA, the feel and the instincts took over and his level of engagement went up. And I think that has potential to happen with LaMelo, given the feel stuff that we've seen from him already defensively.
Yeah, and LaMelo's biggest skill at UCLA was also his team defense, just kind of like playing free safety, which goes to the IQ. And my thing with
Lonzo,
LaMelo and... Yeah, Lonzo, I'm sorry. It's been a long day. My thing with LaMelo then is that if you have someone who's such a high IQ player on offense with good size, who's shown some flashes, then as you pointed out, the consistency isn't there. If you can raise it a little bit, he should be able to get to a good, like a solid to good team defense. It's just getting that consistency down because it was not there.
Let's talk about the shooting now. And I think you're definitely right in regard to his gravity coming out of pick and rolls. It's for me, it's just like the shot IQ, right? It's knowing when to shoot, knowing when to take those shots, knowing when it's smart to take a pull-up jumper in transition or, in the semi-break or after a made basket. Like, that's the stuff that he needs to improve. He can't just have this, like, mindset like he's had throughout his entire life of, okay, it's my team, I can come down and shoot whenever I want. Because, again, this is where the fact that LeVar and LeVar being his coach throughout younger levels of basketball, I think it helped him because he didn't put boundaries on his son's games. But it also does end up hindering him in a very substantial way, because at the end of the day, you do really need to know where your skills are and to know when a good shot is a good shot and a bad shot is a bad shot. As long as he's willing to excise those terrible 30-foot pull-up jumpers in isolation, I agree with you. Like, I think that he does have a real degree of touch. Like, I think that he can be a reasonable shooter in the right situations, as long as the coaching staff that he gets drafted into works with him to excise those bad shots.
Yeah, if you're giving him free rein, then that's going to lead some pretty disastrous, I think, possessions. You want to give him enough confidence to where he's comfortable not feeling restrained, but at the same time, you don't want to just say, okay, here, go cook. Because, as you pointed out, the isolations and the terrible 30-foot pull-ups and all that stuff, it didn't look good. From an aesthetic perspective, but also just from an impact perspective, it didn't help his team at all. And also him in isolation, there are just a couple times I remember him getting bottled up by a big because he just couldn't create that advantage. And he still ended up trying to take the shot anyway.
Yep.
That's got to change too.
Totally agree. Do you have LaMelo at number 1 on your board?
I still do. Yeah.
how far is the difference between him and, I believe, you have Killian Hayes at number two?
Well, Killian's actually in like another tier right now. It's like him and a few other people, but Killian's moved up a bit. It's like, you know, if LaMelo's 100, Killian maybe was at like 90 or so before. Now he's probably at like 94. So he's closing the gap, separating himself, I think, a little bit from the other guys. I just still have LaMelo slightly above just because Killian's non-existent right hand, kind of. I just, you know, that sours me a little bit.
Non-existent right hand that leads to much less shiftiness with ball and just creativity as a ball handler to be able to create that separation that you need at the NBA level. I think that, like, I'm lower on Killian than you are because of that in a real way, and because I have a little bit more concern on the jumper than you do, which we've talked about at length on this podcast before, and I don't think we need to, like, do a rehash of that necessarily. But, yeah, I think that's kind of the key difference here, is that whereas I think Killian may end up being more of a secondary creator, LaMelo has the ball handling ability, the shiftiness, the poise, the dexterity, and the ability to read the second and third levels of defense to actually be a primary creator at the end of the day.
Yeah, like if you're forcing Killian to his right, he's either just going to have a simple kick out to the perimeter, or he's going to go for a step back or a sidestep. He's not going to really be putting much pressure on the rim, and he's not going to be having a hook pass over the shoulder or something like that. But if you force LaMelo either way, he can do that. He can shoot, you know, not consistently yet, but he's comfortable doing it. He's comfortable attacking the rim. He has shown some nice touch with both hands, and he's more than comfortable passing or making any pass with either hand. So that ability to just get everybody a look wherever they are on the court, that's a pretty big differentiator.
Yeah, the live dribble passing is ridiculous with LaMelo Ball. Let's move to the wings, because that's actually what we wanted to talk about on this podcast. So, Isaac Okoro, Devin Vassell, Patrick Williams, Sadiq Bey, Aaron Naismith. Those are the five names that we want to talk about here. And where do you want to start? I guess I'll just kind of pose the question to you. Do you want to start at the bottom, or do you want to start at the top of that group?
Let's start at the bottom, I guess.
So I would say that Sadiq Bey and Aaron Naismith, who I have both of them in the top 17, I think that they're both going to be good NBA players. I would say that they're the two that I have lowest. Do you agree with that duo being lower than the other three?
100%. Yeah.
So which one of Bey or Naismith do you want to talk about to start?
Let's talk about Naismith.
So with Naismith, I see him just as kind of a pure shooter at the end of the day. I don't see a guy that has another incredible skill at the end of the day. Like, I think he'll be a competent defender. I think he will be a like solid team player who you can use coming off of screens, and he can definitely shoot coming off of action. But at the end of the day, I just see him as like a run of the mill top 20, you know, kind of draft pick in this class, because having guys who are elite level shooters is super, super important, but it's not necessarily enough to push beyond that level.
Yep. Yeah, completely agreed. He's bland, I think, kind of everywhere else besides the shooting. And he definitely provides the elite spacing off movement. And, you know, we've seen just how valuable it is with Duncan Robinson or, J.J. Redick and him not being on Philly, and just how much that kind of crapped on their offensive system and spacing and everything. I think Naismith, you know, he's got the shooting, but he's not a good passer. He's not a particularly good defender in that he's going to make many events. He's safe, if not slightly below average, because I think he can be exposed a bit on defense and space.
The thing that worries me with the Duncan Robinson comparison to Naismith is that, yeah, he is great at coming off of screening actions and setting his feet and firing. I don't see the release being quite as quick with Naismith as it is with Duncan Robinson. Like, I don't think he's necessarily going to be the shot creator as a three-point shooter in dribble handoffs and in all kinds of like crazy flare screen actions that Duncan Robinson is going to be. He's probably going to be just that next step lower, which is fine, but you know, Duncan like creates offense unto himself, whereas Naismith, I think, is probably going to be just a little bit more reliant upon others.
Right. Yeah. I just meant in general, just that role.
Yeah.
And just, I mean, obviously, again, as you were just saying, that you can use Robinson in more, more variety of offensive sets. Just that ability to just purely space the court and run, you know, baseline actions for him, or like hammer actions in the secondary break, or whatever it is. I think Naismith will be able to do, And with respect to his, the release point and it being a little bit slower, completely agree to that too. And, you know, being able to go through all of his clips on Synergy or Instat, whatever it is, you can actually see just how affected he is by not only length, but by being closed out, quickly. You know, I think he had like four of his shots blocked from three, which isn't a huge amount, but it's enough to make you think a little bit, because again, the college players that he's playing against are not playing in the NBA for the most part next year, unless if it's an Isaac Okoro or, you know, John Petty in 2 years, I guess. They're just not as good. So the fact that he was able to get bothered enough to where maybe the shot was a little bit, you know, bothered, I know it's redundant, at the college level, I don't necessarily think it's going to be as good at the next level. And there's no way he is as good a shooter as he was this year at the next level. And I think people just kind of see the 52% or whatever it was he shot from three this year and think, oh, like, you know, holy crap, that's fantastic. And, you know, the volume, it was solid volume. It was good. I mean, it was fantastic volume for the games that he played in. But when you combine it with what he did last year, and sure, you can obviously progress a lot from 1 year to another, you kind of see that he's not that elite shooter. He's a good one, very good one. He's just not as good as some think he is.
Well, and you look at the quality of competition he played, it was not as strong as, you know, an SEC level schedule, because he got hurt one game into the SEC season. And when that happens, it's going to kind of skew the numbers a little bit. Like, he played Southeast Missouri State, Texas A&M Corpus Christi, Austin Peay, South Carolina State, Southeastern Illinois, Tulsa, UNC Wilmington, Davidson. That's eight games there out of the 14 that he played, where I would not say that the defense there was particularly solid. Like, he played Liberty as another team that was pretty good this year defensively, but another mid-major team that doesn't necessarily have NBA level length, despite the fact that Caleb Holmesley is something of an NBA prospect on some level. Played Buffalo as well, another mid-major that, again, good team, not necessarily an elite level team in terms of the length and athleticism that they present on the wing. So it's just, it's a lot easier for him to generate shots with that slightly slower release against opponents like that than it is against NBA level talent. For instance, he played 39 minutes against Auburn and only generated 6 3-point attempts, which was his, I believe, second lowest three-point attempt output on the season in those 14 games. And you could see Auburn's length. I don't want to say it bothered him from a shooting perspective, but it did certainly close off those lanes and those shooting lanes in a way that you didn't necessarily see earlier in the season with him.
Yep. And because it's slightly slower, if, you know, you obviously still need to be on point with the closeouts, but if you're that half second slower, if you're half second slow to get to him, and if you chase him off the line, he's not pulling up really. And I think that's actually why I don't have him as the best shooter in the draft overall. I actually don't have him as either of my top two, because I think that's such an important skill for shooters to have. You need to be able to attack guys off the bounce. And I think it was Henry Ward. He wrote a piece 2 weeks ago, maybe, where he talked about that being such an important skill. And I think it is. And obviously the shooting's elite in and of itself, but you still need to be able to complement that some way.
And then let's go to Sadiq Bey here. With Bey, again, an elite level shooter in terms of the numbers, but because Bey isn't particularly good coming off of actions and setting his feet and firing quickly, I worry that he's going to be slightly worse. Like, both of these guys, I think, are going to be 40% NBA three-point shooters, especially out of catch-and-shoot spot situations. I just worry that, you know, Sadiq Bey is not going to be like a 45% three-point shooter, and then what happens once that number drops slightly to the rest of his game?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the volume is going to be there either. Like, as you said, it's just going to be a lot of stationary stuff, and that's definitely important just to be able to hit those. And I think he's going to be spending most of his time as a small ball four, which maybe makes it a little bit more important than just him doing it as a three. But him not having that super high three-point volume or the ability to just constantly keep defenses on their toes by being on the move all the time, I think it lowers the ceiling a little bit.
Yeah, what I will say on Bey that I like better with Naismith, and it's why I have Bey slightly higher than Naismith on my board, is that Bey, I think, can attack closeouts a little bit better than Naismith can. I think he's a better passer. He makes the simple read. He makes that very strong, you know, kick out pass to keep the chain moving and eventually find that wide open three while defenses try to scramble in rotation. I think he's good at finding that pass. I think he's much better at finding that pass than Aaron Naismith is. Overall, I think that even if his shooting isn't going to be quite as good as Naismith's is in terms of volume and in terms of percentage, I think his overall offensive game is a little bit stronger than Naismith's over in total.
Yeah, I completely agree. He's not going to be creating his own shot, I don't think. At least, you know, unless if he's playing against someone smaller and you just kind of straight up use his strength. But the ability to attack the closeouts and to make those passes, I think, gives him that extra edge that Naismith doesn't have.
So, defensively, I like Bey quite a bit as someone who can make pretty good defensive reads and can slide with smaller players for his size. I don't think he's necessarily like a switch guy onto the league's best guards, because very few guys are, but I do think he's quick enough to take on relatively tougher defensive assignments. And while he won't necessarily be an elite level team defender, he will be someone that can at least cause issues due to his length and strength for some of his opposition and some of the NBA's bigger wings that you see across the league.
Completely agreed. And also, him coming from Villanova's just fundamentally sound defense and constantly minimizing mistakes, I think that's going to help him a good amount also. He's going to know the right places to be. But I think more important than that is he's not going to be taking any bad gambles. He's not going to be, making silly mistakes. I think that's going to separate him. And then I don't think he'll be able to play against, you know, the quick point guards, but in a pinch, like, sure. I think really with him, it's just going to be him getting to that physicalness to where he can defend fours pretty consistently. And then if he has to, he can defend threes and maybe twos a little bit as well. It's just going to be, you know, the two through four, unless at the one, whereas Naismith is just a two, three, probably just a three. Then maybe a tiny bit of switching up, but that's it.
Yeah, with Bey, I see him as mostly being a spot-up, catch-and-shoot, three-point guy who can attack closeouts and make good reads, and then be a non-difference-making, solidly average to slightly above-average defensive player. Imagine like Alan Crabb plus almost Sadiq Bey. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I would actually use that more with Naismith.
I think left. Naismith is just like Alan Crabb, whereas like with Bey, it's like slightly better.
Okay. Yeah, but I think Crabbe has a little bit more movement shooting to his game than Bay does. And I think the defense, Bay has the edge there also, though I was never really a fan of Crabbe, and I never understood why some Knicks fans wanted him. Was it 6-7 years ago? Whatever it was. I don't really have a comparison for him. He just kind of is like Sadiq Bey. Like, I know it's like a silly thing to say, but I don't really have anything on that.
It's almost like Jeremy Grant has become a reasonable shooter, but Jeremy is way more athletic than he is. Like, at least Sadiq has that's similar size, similar length, way less athletic, but way better shooter.
I think I have one. Late end of the career, like a Paul Millsap type.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking that too. Like, I think that Millsap is just way stronger than Bay. Like, yeah. Bay is strong, yeah. But Millsap is
he's thick just, and he uses it well.
Totally different dude. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to find the guy who Sadiq Bey is, but I think it's going to be a pretty useful, valuable player. Is it Royce O'Neal, maybe?
With more offense and maybe not the full defensive capabilities?
Yeah, it's hard to find. It's hard to find that guy. Like, it's just really, really hard to figure out who Sadiq Bey compares to, but it's just different. Like, it's, he'll be fine. Like, everything about his skill set says that he should be an effective player. Let's move to, I have Pat Williams kind of in a tier on his own among this fivesome. I have a Coro and Vassell in a tier, and then I have Pat Williams just kind of by himself. Where do you fall on this trio here?
Yeah, same place. I have a Core one and have a Cell. But Pat Williams, I think there's a pretty sizable gap between him and the other two on either side.
It's funny because you and I typically rarely agree on things in this draft, and we have this the same way. That makes me feel better about things right now.
Go us.
So Pat Williams, 6'8", 6'11", 7-foot wingspan, somewhere in that range. Just enormous. He looks absolutely enormous on the court. Going to grow into a frame that is going to allow him to play the four, and I think even some potentially small ball five, but going to be able to play 3 through 5 pretty reasonably by the time he's 25 years old. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I have him definitely more of a four than the three, but yeah. I think as he continues to get stronger, I could absolutely see him playing some small ball five. And I think his upper body is actually the part that has to develop a little bit more.
Yep.
Just because his legs are so massive. And when you want to defend bigger players, you want that strong base, that ability to just, keep your leverage and all that. And he has that. So it's just, once he gets a little bit stronger in the upper body, which is scary because he's still strong in the upper body, he'll be able to play up pretty, I think, easily.
Yeah, and he also has enormous shoulders too.
Yeah,
that you would believe are going to be very easy to put weight on as well as he continues to just fill out his upper half. I don't really. So the popular point of comparison that I've seen a few people make is OG Anunoby, just in terms of raw offensive player who had great defensive instincts and has this super human frame almost. Anunoby is way more athletic and laterally quick, I think, than what Williams is. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, Pat, he's very strong in his lower body, but I also think in space you see it to his detriment, to where he's slow to flip his hips. He's not great keeping guys in front of him. Whereas OG, in addition to having the 7'5 wingspan, he's just much more fluid.
Yeah, totally agree with that. And with Williams, whereas with Anunoby, he was a better on-ball defender at Indiana, Williams is a better off-ball defender I think he makes these quick reaction times. Like we talked about the fact that, you know, Aaron Naismith, Sadiq Bey, these guys aren't really playmakers defensively off the ball. I actually think Pat Williams is a playmaker defensively off the ball. Like he makes rotations into being a really good rim protector who uses verticality, who can block shots, who can contest at the basket. And then he also makes pretty good rotations into passing lanes as well.
Yeah, he's got the quick ability to just kind of like know where to be on the perimeter, but then in the paint when he is protecting the rim, even if he's coming from the weak side, and if someone's coming at him, he's strong enough to withstand it at the rim, to get his hand on the ball, to alter the shot, whatever it is, and affect it. Like I think he's going to be a fantastic team defender, and like I'd put money on that if I gambled, and if that were an actual bet that I could put money on. But
yeah, you gotta find an NBA executive that like totally disbelieves Pat Williams and just like bet dinner on it. Like that's how you got to make this happen. I
would bet.
I don't speak from experience here. Let me tell you.
Yeah. Pat, he's a fantastic defender. And like Leonard Hamilton just coaches defense so well. And even like beyond all the event creation that he has, he talks so much. And like, mm-hmm. I love seeing that from bigs.
Yeah, he's definitely a talker, definitely someone that communicates regularly. I think that Florida State scheme and the way that Leonard Hamilton teaches defense, it just forces that out of bigs a lot of the time. Offensively is where I'm a little bit more worried because he is very raw. I think he has better playmaking ability than what people tend to give him credit for. But I worry a little bit more about where the jump shot is and how he's going to be able to transition into a role in an NBA offense.
Yeah. So completely agreed with the passing. Like the few times we actually saw him run some sets, he was hitting live action passes. And I actually think he had more of them with his left hand than his right hand this year.
Yep. He did.
And they're accurate too. And from a four, if you can run some four or five pick and rolls, some inverted pick and rolls, whatever, like having that ability to just see over the court and hit those passes is going to be huge. He's not a movement shooter. He's not, plain and simple. I don't think he ever will be, but I do think he will be a good, you know, maybe not 40% on plus volume, but, you know, high 30s on solid volume from three. And then I think he has that ability to take and make pull up jump shots also. The release I think is a little bit slow maybe, but he has nice pop on and off the bounce, so I'm not sure how much of an issue that's going to be. But I like the shot. I don't think it's really going to be his calling card. I think it's going to be him being such a good defender and him being a good passer and just kind of being solid, few mistakes on offense, that's going to make him get him to that, you know, plus impact player.
Yeah, the fact that he's going to be able to play really, really well as a team defender. And then also, I think he's going to transition well into playing as a team offensive player as long as the jump shot comes along off the catch. Like, if he can be a kickout threat to a corner, drive baseline, and then use his left hand to make those pinpoint passes once defenders have to rotate into help in order to stop him at the rim, because he is a very good finisher as well, I think that it's going to transition really, really well. It's just going to depend on the jump shot. I think I'm a little bit more skeptical on the jump shot because, man, the arc is incredibly high. It's kind of all over the place in terms of release point. Like, it's going to take, I think, a little bit of time for him to really iron out those mechanics in terms of the jump shot.
It's not Sekou or Dort level of arc, though. So he's got that going for him.
Yes, he does not shoot quite as high as the guys who shoot the highest in the NBA, anyone.
Yeah.
So that's good. But
I like his ability to also play off the ball, even aside from the shooting, which, like, you know, I buy. It's the cutting, it's the crashing the offensive glass, it's the off-ball screening. I think he does a nice job actually setting screens, you know, for flares and stuff like that. I think that's going to be another way that you could use him in the NBA.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I actually understand why people would rather have him than Devin Vassell. And I think it's because of that defensive difference-making ability. Because with Vassell, he is a good defender, and he's someone that really contests on the ball. But I actually do think that Williams is probably going to be a better, more impactful defender than Vassell. Do you agree with that?
I guess maybe from a versatility perspective, I think, you know, Pat's going to have the edge there, even if he's not defending down because he's just not, he's slow, flipping his hips and all that stuff. I don't think Vassell can really defend outside of, you know, the 2-3, and I don't think he moves particularly well at the point of attack. Just Vassell is just such a, like, elite team defender, and as good as Pat is, I think Vassell is still better. It's just how much more weight do you put into that over the you know, the versatility that Pat might provide?
Yeah, for me it's like playmaking and versatility for Williams, and like I want guys that are like just physically stronger come playoff time, right? Like for me, like that's going to be the difference. Whereas like Vassell, I'm not saying that Vassell is not strong. I just think he is going to be a little bit more limited in terms of who you end up putting him on. Having said that, I don't mean that to disparage Vassell, who I do have slightly higher than Pat Williams on my board, in large part because he's at least relatively close to Williams as a team defender and as an impact defender, I should say, while also being just a very, very, very high level shooter. And that high level shooting ability is going to transition into being a role player who is going to start a lot of NBA games in his career exceptionally well.
I think so. I mean, Vassell is absolutely, like, he's a good shooter. The question for me, I guess, on from that angle is, will he take enough threes to actually have an impact? Because, you know, Robert Covington, he's a good offensive player because he's taking 9 threes a game, and even though he's not hitting at a high clip, the defense is going out to contest him because he's taking 9 threes a game at 34-35%, whatever it is. I don't think Vassell is going to get there. And like, if you combined Naismith's movement shooting with Vassell, that would be, I mean, that's Mikal Bridges, I guess, but better.
Right.
Like that would, you know, I'd completely understand having Vassell as high as some people have him, as 4 or whatever it is, but I don't think he's going to have that much gravity from 3 unless if he really just starts to pump up the volume, and I don't know if he really has that ability to do that.
So generally, I do agree. I will say that, like, in the small sample that we had going into his sophomore year, so his freshman year, he was a much more voluminous three-point shooter. Like, he took 7 three-point attempts per 40 minutes last year as a freshman and knocked them down at a 42% clip. Similarly to this year, he knocked down shots at a 41.5% clip from 3. The issue is just how long the release is. Like, it takes him a while to get them off. Mm-hmm. If he can tighten that up a little bit, I think that it's going to lead to very real substantial results in terms of him being able to get more shots up and get that volume up. I worry a little bit about that, though. I do. I'm kind of with you there. I think he's basically a pure fourth or fifth starter, like, sixth man wing who you can play at a high level in the playoffs. Like, is he kind of similar to what we see from Kentavious Caldwell-Pope right now for the Lakers, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I could see something like that. I think KCP might have a little bit more ability to shoot off movement, even if it's not particularly good there.
KCP was also like a pretty heavy pull-up shooter at Georgia
too. Yeah, I remember that.
So very different,
stronger, I think.
Yeah, very different, like, prospects coming in, but I mean purely in terms of the role that KCP plays now for the Lakers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that I 100% agree with.
Like, I think he's going to be a guy that spots up in the corner, spots up above the break, knocks down shots at a 40% clip from three. Maybe it's like, honestly, maybe it's Danny Green. Like, is that who Devin Vassell is? Like, slightly worse, less strong Danny Green?
Again, going back to the movement, I think Green's got him a little bit there, but I think Vassell might have more of a mid-range game. Just that ability to pull up off the bounce.
A little bit. Like, people have brought up the improvement from Vassell as a mid-range shooter and as a pull-up shooter, and I really worry about how long it takes him to get those shots off. Like, he does have that elongated movement at the top of the shot that I think just allows defenders to close out a little bit quicker than what we see at the college level. Like, NBA defenders, I think, are actually going to be able to close out on him and cause some issues as a pull-up shooter, I think.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. Yeah.
Are we, like, kind of talking ourselves into wondering if Pat Williams should be ahead of Devin Vassell?
I think it's more about maybe me moving Vassell slightly down. I don't know. I mean, this is also just making me that much, you know, higher on Okoro. So,
like, yeah, no,
I keep doing this because I love Okoro.
Yeah, I have Okoro at 6 right now, and have Vassell at 11, Williams at 14, Bay at 15, Naismith at 17. And I guess that before we close with Okoro, let's finish on Vassell. Let me just ask you, what is your final, like, what do you think Devin Vassell is, and where do you think that disconnect is from people that have him considerably higher than we do?
I mean, I think people think that he's Mikal Bridges. I think that's where that disconnect is, and being as high on Mikal as I was, you know, in, was it 2018 draft? I don't see it. Like, you know, Mikal was just longer. He moved better off the ball. He was a better movement shooter. He was a better finisher. He had some pick and roll ability. Not saying Vassell doesn't, but, you know, when Jay Wright let him do it, he was playing the pick and roll pretty well. And, like, just, I think it's very difficult to really up the 3-point rate enough to have that being, like, you know, some massive skill that you have. And I don't think he's really going to be able to get to that 7 attempt a game, 6, I mean, maybe 5, but, like, that extra attempt could be the difference between him being, you know, that fourth starter versus being the first guy off the bench.
Yeah, like, I think he can get there, and I think, honestly, he probably will get there because he's going to have more creative players playing around him. Like, he's someone where if Phoenix drafted him and put him next to Devin Booker, I think that would be and put him next to Mikal Bridges as well. Like, I think that'd be amazing because they would have enough guys to get him open shots. You would have DeAndre Ayton forcing defenders to collapse down in the paint, and you would have Devin Booker, who is genuinely probably a top 10 player offensively in the NBA as soon as next year. Putting Vassell in that situation where he can just knock down spot up shots and move a little bit off of action, I think that that's how you get the most out of Vassell. I don't think you get the most out of him by putting him in, say, New York, where he's not going to have anyone around him really to create, depending on what they do this summer.
Completely agree to the part about New York. But with Phoenix, I actually don't like it that much. I think Booker can definitely handle all the perimeter creation on his own, but I think you still need that secondary creator. And I think having Mikal and Vassell, they overlap too much with skill sets and with deficiencies as well, to where I don't really know if it's going to elevate either of their games.
I don't know that it elevates either of their games necessarily, but it just gives them so many different options from a wing perspective to where I'm very interested in pairing those two with, like, Cam Johnson and with Devin and even with, like, Ricky Rubio. Like, they could realistically in those situations close games with Vassell and Bridges, I think, at the 3 and the 4 even. or they could close with, like, if there's a specific matchup where you don't want to close with DeAndre at the five, like, you could probably figure out a way to get all of Cam Johnson, Devin Vassell, Mikal Bridges, Devin Booker, and, like, a guard on the court if you really just want to be able to switch all actions and play, like, this crazy hyper-aggressive defensive style.
How many teams can actually would allow for that, though, to where there's just no true not doesn't even have to be a post-up threat, just somebody who's not going to live in the paint or somebody who can't attack the paint? I mean, I guess Houston, you know, you could deploy it against Houston.
Even Boston, but, I think you could deploy it reasonably.
Right. That is until they draft Xavier Tillman and everything becomes gold. Yeah.
Well, I'll have to let you come on and talk about Xavier Tillman more. But yeah, I like Devin Vassell. I like him as a second half of the lottery pick. It sounds like you're kind of in agreement there.
Yeah. Yeah, like I wouldn't take him at 8 if I'm the Knicks. And I'm trying to hammer that home.
Let's talk about Okoro. So you said that you love Okoro. Why do you love Isaac Okoro as much as you do?
I mean, it's silly, I guess, saying this because, you know, of how valuable shooting is, but the only thing he doesn't have on offense is shooting.
Yep, agree.
It's as simple as that. He's a very good passer, and Auburn's offense didn't allow much for anyone to really control the offense at all. So a lot of his stuff was just, you know, when he got it, and if he had an opportunity, he'd do something with it. But he's a legitimately good secondary creator, and I think he can definitely create a little bit as a primary, not as in like not attacking off a swinging action or anything like that. But he's such a good finisher. He's such a good cutter. He's just so smart, on offense. Like it's hard not to just buy that. And I think I buy shots probably a little bit more easily than you do. You know, I buy him being a serviceable enough 3-point shooter on catch and shoots to allow for his ability to attack the rim. And, who is it? Forgot who it was. Who's one of the people on Count the Dings? He was the old video coordinator. He wrote the piece on cutting and how that's another great way to create spacing.
Oh, Mo DeKeon.
Yeah. That's another thing with him. Like, people just forget that you can create spacing by cutting, and Okoro does that really, really well. And then the defense, I also love. Like, he's not a Vassell level team defender, but I think he's much more versatile. I think he's a better point of attack defender, and I think in terms of team defense, he's not the Vassell level, he's just below that, so he's not elite, he's still very good, but he has that edge in the point of attack, and you can't target him on defense, and that's huge.
Yeah, it's the strength. It's point of attack defense mixed with the strength of not being able to, like, post him at all, or get him, like, at the mid-post level if you're a Giannis and, like, just totally bully by him, right? Like, you might be able to, I guess, if you're Giannis, but or if you're LeBron, but anyone else, like, I don't know that you can do that with Okoro, whereas you probably could with Vassell. So yeah, I totally agree with you. I think that him and Vassell are very close defensively, and I think that I actually agree with you on offense as well. I love Isaac Okoro's game offensively. I think that his ability to read the second and third level of the defense is exceptionally strong. He can make live dribble passes. The way that he can maneuver his body around the basket, he actually has, like, interesting Euro step skills. He has some very real ability to maneuver his body in the air. He knows how to angle his body when finding angles around rim protectors in order to finish in creative ways. Really, it just all comes down to the shot. And it's funny that you mentioned that you don't think, like, I tend to buy shots. I actually buy Okoro's shot a little bit more than what I typically would with someone like him who's coming from such a low level as a shooter. He is a pretty, his rhythm and his ability to pull up is actually pretty interesting to me. Like, I think that he looks much better as a pull-up shooter than he does as a shooter off the catch. And I think it's because he has that exaggerated ball dip off the catch that just naturally goes away whenever you're pulling up as a shooter. And if you can just get rid of that ball dip, I wonder if there's some real potential there.
Yeah, I mean, he had some nice just self-created or, you know, attacking the closeouts where he's pulling up or sidesteps from mid-range this year that, like, I buy that. And, I mean, the footwork, I think, is that's an issue for catch and shoot, but his touch in the paint is just so soft with, like, either hand also. It's, like, just putting, I guess, all that into an equation, you know, the touch and, you know, as you were saying, the rhythm and the pull-up jump shots and, you know, the footwork, the pull-up jump shots and just his, like, the only thing missing really is the footwork and the catch and shoot and just getting that rhythm down. Like, he has to just get to mid-30s, like 34%, 35%, and then that's it. Like, then I think he's going to be one of the most, I mean, it might be hyperbolic. He's going to be one of the most complete, I think, offensive players potentially, like in the NBA, just between the finishing, between the passing, between the not being able to completely ignore him, between the cutting, the crashing the offensive glass, just everything. I don't really think he'll have many holes.
Yeah, the jump shot is the swing skill here. If he gets the jump shot, like, there's like a not, like, the popular comparison has been Jimmy Butler here, just in terms of frame and in terms of strength and ability to handle the ball and the way his, you know, body mechanics work and strength, right? I actually like kind of see a little bit of that upside there.
And just like the endless motor, like, he's not going to take a play off. And was it the game at Alabama? I think he defended like 1-5. Like, the first half, it was Kyra. The second half, it was just like everybody. And like, I like guys who aren't going to back down from anyone. I like guys who have that versatility and just, he's not going to take a play off. And, you know, obviously Butler had that insane development curve. But I think Okoro maybe comes from a higher floor at the same stage also. So he does, it doesn't have to be as extreme to get to some Jimmy Butler-esque level. Not saying, you know, he's going to be that top 10 impact player that Butler is, top 12 impact player that Butler is, but just getting to that like two-way ability that every team's going to want. I think that's going to happen.
I think it has a really strong chance to happen as well. I have him at number 6 right now. It would not stun me if he moved as high as number 4 or number 5 by the time this process is done. I am very clearly a fan of what Isaac Okoro brings to the table as an NBA prospect, and I would be willing to bet on him somewhere 4, 5, 6 in that range pretty easily. Where do you have him?
Yeah, he's actually in my 2-5 range. Yeah. Like, if I would take him above Anthony Edwards, not think twice about it. You know, I'd be more than happy taking him at 2 if I'm Golden State, except I don't think they will. I think there's a very low bust potential with him, with a really high impact potential.
So we're going to have you back on to talk about Anthony Edwards if you have him at number 6, I guess, in the case of Edwards, something like that.
Yeah, I think he's 5. Just like, they're in that same tier, but he's, I guess, that tier unto himself. It's like, it's Hayes, Denny, Okoro. Actually, no, he might be 6. I think Anthony Edwards is 6th.
Yeah, if you're going to take Hayes, or if you're going to take Edwards over Okoro, or if you're not going to take Edwards over Okoro, we're going to have a conversation again. Spencer, you're going to have to come back on at some point in the next month and talk about all of this stuff with me. Tell the people where they can find your work, man.
I mean, I'd love to come back. They can find my scouting reports up at the Stepien, and my Twitter feed is graced with boundless clips at SK Perlman. Just so many basketball clips. So follow me there.
It seems like it's all that Spencer does is just grab clips and watch basketball. So we are going to have him back on at some point very soon to go in depth on guys like Anthony Edwards and Denny Avdija. Cause it seems like you're higher on Denny than I am, which is interesting to me. And it's not that I dislike Denny. Like, he's very clearly in that like 4 to 11 tier for me. Cause I don't have anyone in like my top tier this year, and then I have the next three guys in my second tier. So we'll have to have you back very soon to talk about that. This has been the Game Theory Podcast. Please remember, rate, review, subscribe, do everything you do to support the podcast, leave reviews, leave ratings, all of that stuff. We'll be back later this week with potentially more on the NBA Finals if they end up closing down on Friday. But until next time, we'll talk soon. Bye.